It is such a pleasure today to introduce you to Norman Krieger, who enjoys a flourishing career as a performance pianist and teacher. Currently, he's a professor of piano and chair of music at Indiana University. And yet with everything he's got going on, still somehow made time to release this new album, which we'll be talking about today, an album of works by George Gershwin. And of course, Norman, when I was looking over the track listing, you had me at Rhapsody in Blue. It's just so iconic, right? But I think the entire album our Gershwin fans are going to love. So thank you so much for taking the time to be here on Classical Conversations.
My pleasure. It's great to be here. It's so nice to meet you. And thank you for your kind words.
Your path in music, it's taken you all over the place. I mean, you've traveled throughout the country and throughout the world. I wondered if you could share maybe a few highlights of different places or people that you've met that you feel like helped shape that journey.
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, I have to start, of course, with my family, my parents. They were from Eastern Europe, from Poland and Russia and Germany, and they escaped Second World War, went to China, and then came to America. So music was always a part of our family. No matter what field you were going to go into, you had to study an instrument. So my grandmother made it very clear that I had to practice, you know, whatever instrument, violin or piano, half an hour every day before I could go out and play with my friends. And so that sort of stuck. And then my mother took me to concerts, and I heard great artists like the first great musician I heard was Jascha Heifetz, the very famous violinist, which kind of changed my life because I'd never heard anybody play any instrument like that. And then I started going to concerts, hearing people like Arthur Rubinstein, Rudolf Serkin, Mstislav Rostropovich, Jacqueline Dupre, Zubin Mehta was the conductor in Los Angeles when I was growing up. So I would play for him. I got to meet people and play for people like Martha Argerich, Misha Dichter. You know, LA was quite a rich environment culturally. And of course, now it's sort of, you know, blossomed into this incredible place. But then I moved to New York and I went to Juilliard when I was 15. And there I heard almost every night a different concert, opera, ballet, Broadway play. So I was around music 24/7, and not only music, but great art and great artists. My best friend in college was Myung-hun Chung, who I still consider my best friend. He's now, internationally renowned conductor. I mean, but he's a phenomenal pianist. He had a huge influence on me as a musician, and also Adele Marcus, who was my teacher at Juilliard, and Russell Sherman, who I also studied with at New England Conservatory, and Alfred Brendel in London. Those were the really big, powerful musical influences. In addition to my family, my uncle was my first teacher, and Esther Lipton in Los Angeles, those early, you know, sort of foundational people changed my life and sort of set the bar in terms of excellence and sort of inspired me to, you know, I guess from the age of 8 on, I didn't consider any other field. It just sort of music took over. And so since the days at Juilliard, you know, I'm still friendly with many of my classmates. You know, the funny thing is, you know, when you're a performer, you wish you could do your 9-to-5 by going to perform in the same place every night, but unfortunately it doesn't work that way, which means that you have to travel and you have to, you know, but that's kind of a blessing and a curse at the same time, because when you travel, you stay in different hotels, you play on different pianos, but you get to meet so many interesting people, see different countries. And I've had the privilege of playing all over the world in Asia. I played in China. I played in Taiwan, Korea, Thailand, South America, many of the countries, all over Europe, Russia, Poland, Czech Republic, Canada. You know, so I've been to quite a few places. The only place I haven't gone to yet is Africa. I would love to go and visit you know, and play a concert there. I understand there's, you know, quite a few interesting places to play, but yeah, so I have to pinch myself, you know, when there's so much going on in the world that's not positive. It's nice to be able to say thank you, you know, that I'm doing something I love and that something that hopefully will touch the listener's heart in a positive way. And so, yeah, I've sort of thrown a lot of things in there, but I've had, you know, my life is very interesting. I'm playing now in Brevard a piece that I didn't know about 5 months ago. It's the piano quintet by Ray Vaughan Williams. And so it's very difficult and it's very, you know, challenging, but I'm looking forward to it. I'm playing it on July 10th. So I'm learning this new piece. And then of course, then I go to Chautauqua after Brevard, and then I'm going to, then school starts and I'm chair of the piano department at IU, where I have, you know, my 10 wonderful colleagues and, you know, 175 piano students.
So you have this new piece that you've been working on recently, but the Gershwin, that's something that you've revisited across the course of your career, right?
Yes. My first recording was actually the same repertoire, but for solo piano. And that was in 1988, I think. And this most recent recording is with orchestra. The, you know, the Rhapsody in Blue was the piece that Gershwin wrote very last minute, but he originally wrote it for band and piano, a symphonic band with Paul Whiteman, who was conducting. And that was 100 years ago. It's hard to believe. So the arrangement I'm doing on this recording is the Ferdi Groffay, who wrote, you know, Grand Canyon Suite, but he orchestrated this and did quite a wonderful job. Then the Concerto in F next year will be 100 years old, which is really kind of hard to believe, because both those pieces are kind of, you know, representative of a time in America where, you know, there was a lot of hope and people were looking forward to opportunities, and just like today, but I think a little bit even more so. And so Gershwin's music to me is all about hope, joy, compassion, dancing, singing, and a reflection of the hustle and bustle of American life in the 1920s. We need that now more than ever, I think, in the world. And so it's, you know, interesting that it's 100 years since both those pieces were composed. And yet they're still staples of the repertoire and beloved, not only in America, but all over the world. So I'm really honored to have the privilege to have this released on Universal Classics. So I'm excited, and I'm going to be playing it quite a bit this coming season.
How do you feel like your techniques or even conceptualization of these Gershwin works has changed from when you first started playing to now?
It's a very interesting question. I would say when I was younger, I probably took more liberties with the music, meaning more rubati or, you know, more focused on interpretation rather than presentation. And what I find is if you go back and you look at the videos or now, you know, the film footage of Broadway shows from the 1920s, like, or with Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, they don't interpret what they sing or dance. They present it. Meaning there's very little manipulation of time. And yet there's elegance, there's charm. And that's how I think Gershwin's music sounds best, really, when it's just sort of left alone. And it doesn't mean that you're not playing with feeling or emotion, but it's the music is so potent as it was written that if you align your feeling, it's kind of like the music of Maurice Ravel, you know, who actually said, in an interview, he says, my music doesn't need to be interpreted. It just needs to be played. Because he wrote everything in the score that he wanted and didn't like people manipulating, taking too much time and what have you. So that's how I approach it in these recordings. Maybe the word is lean, but still with passion and with feeling. But I try to capture that flavor of the 1920s, the same way I would if I was playing Mozart. You know, I certainly wouldn't play Mozart like Rachmaninoff or, I try to capture the Viennese classical style. So in this case, I try to capture the Charleston dance, which Gershwin used, you know, that rhythm, that bum, 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 ba-da-da-dee-dum, ba-da-da-dee-dum. You know, it's one of those, you know, if you look at the films from the 1920s. So it's more about rhythm, dynamics, direction, and a suave kind of pleasure in phrasing. If you hear Fred Astaire sing a tune from the 1920s, that's how I try to play Gershwin and how he dances. I mean, it's just so elegant, and it's not about him, in other words. It's about the message. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah. I am curious, I mean, since you do so much teaching too, I'm curious how you convey that message to your students, or to what degree for students is that just a process of discovery? I mean, if someone were to come in learning, you know, this piano concerto in F for the very first time, how much do you teach directly from your own experience versus how much do you just try to give them a nudge in the right direction?
That's such a great question, because that's probably the hardest part of teaching, where when I, you know, as a teacher, if I'd known a piece for 30 years, and I get a student coming in and has learned it, you know, studied it for 2 weeks, I have to work really hard not to superimpose my conception on that person, but to let them take their journey, but guide them, and not have them necessarily imitate me, but that I can influence them in the direction stylistically and pianistically that I feel is a healthy journey or part of their journey, but they need to take their own journey. You know, it's kind of like when I was a student at Juilliard, I remember I came to a lesson and I said to my teacher, she said, why are you doing that, dear, in this Chopin piece? And I said, oh, I listened to Horowitz on RCA, you know, and she said, dear, you don't know the journey that Mr. Horowitz took to get to that conclusion. You're only listening to the end of his journey. And, you know, if you want to do that, then you should study with RCA. And I thought, wow, that was quite a statement. You know, so I say that to my students. I said, well, who have you listened to someone play that? And say, yeah. And I would say, who? They say, oh, YouTube. I said, Mr. or Mrs. You know, it's like sometimes they don't even know who the artist is that's playing, you know. And I say, you know, you have to use discretion. And that's really hard with, you know, the bombardment of media and access to so many different kinds of performances. I always, my motto really is that the piano is the instrument that imitates everyone else. We imitate the human voice, we imitate the flute, we imitate percussion, we imitate brass. And so we have to use the piano. In my teaching, I talk about using the piano as a means to an end, not an end in itself. So in Gershwin's case, the good news is he was a pianist himself. So he writes pretty pianistically, meaning that it fits the hand logically. And but, you know, his music is, it's readily accessible, you know, that's not a condescending remark. You know, I mean, the two greatest songwriters of all time, in my opinion, are Franz Schubert and George Gershwin. I mean, who writes a better tune than George Gershwin? And so, again, you know, my influence on my students is to try to give them the fundamentals of technique, structure, harmony, tempo, pulse, and to understand as much as possible what's written in the score, what the composer's intention is. Because, you know, from my perspective and the way I was brought up musically, the music is the star, not the performer. We are servants. We are vessels for the composer. And so, you know, it can be challenging because so much of what you see in social media, even in classical music, is about visual stuff, has very little to do with the actual art. It's almost like a form of entertainment, you know. And I was not raised that way. And I was encouraged not to be, not to take that road, you know. But it's an inside job, meaning that as a pianist, our mission is to listen. It's all about the sound for me, not about histrionics, and certainly not about it's not about the artist that's playing. I feel that very strongly, like great actors. You know, if you see a Meryl Streep or a Sean Penn or you know, Anthony Hopkins or Judi Dench, they're playing the characters. They're a vessel for the character they're playing, and I feel that way about great music. That we as performers should, and that's what I teach to my students, is that we should be at the service of the music.
Thinking about that concept of musicians as vessels and with that mission to listen, what would you say the audience mission might be?
Not to be on their cell phones and to turn their cell phones off and to actually listen, to close their eyes. You know, and listen, at least with pianists. I mean, you know, I'm very blessed. I have one student who's completely blind. And so he has no option but to listen. And, you know, it's really, he sort of sets this incredibly high standard of, you know, first of all, you know, he can't read music. He learns it all by ear. And when he plays, it's all based on listening. And so therefore, he hears everything. And so it's amazing when I'm teaching, sometimes I'll just say to a student, you're listening about 75%. You need to make it at least 100%. And what I do myself when I practice is sometimes I'll practice under tempo, so much slower, and I'll close my eyes. And I'll just focus on what I hear rather than being distracted by the keyboard or by something that's going on in the room, you know, et cetera. And that helps me to listen. And also, it's interesting, for me personally, it helps me to relax my body so that I can just focus on the sound. And all the other muscles in my body then are at the service of the tips of the fingers, which is the point of contact when you're a pianist. You know, it's like the moment of truth happens right at the tip of the finger. It's a discipline that can actually be learned. You know, it's not rocket science, but the problem I find with a lot of younger students in particular is, you know, they listen to music with these AirPods or, you know, and when I was a student at Juilliard, I saved all my money to buy a stereo system, you know, with speakers and just having that three-dimensional kind of sound is so different than listening. No matter how good the AirPods are, it's not the same as listening to sound in a room, you know, with really good speakers, you know. And of course, live concert, it's the best.
Yeah, there's just nothing like that immersive experience, really.
Right.
Just circling back, though, to the Gershwin album, is there anything you would like to add that you feel listeners should know before diving into the album?
No, just I hope they enjoy listening to it. I'm proud of the recording. I recorded it with my dear colleague and friend, Neil Gittleman, who's the music director of the Dayton Philharmonic in Ohio. And he's done an incredible service to that community and that orchestra. I don't know if you've ever been to that hall. It's a beautiful, beautiful concert hall. And the orchestra is just really extraordinary. And he's a very special musician. I hope people enjoy listening to it.
I've been speaking with Norman Krieger on his album of Gershwin music, including the Rhapsody in Blue, Piano Concerto in F, and several of the Gershwin preludes. And of course, this year being the centennial of the Rhapsody in Blue, there's no better time to listen. So look it up. It's called Norman Krieger Plays Gershwin. And I guess all that remains to be said is thank you to you, Norman. I appreciate you taking the time.
So nice to meet you.